face of the earth has never been more than a jump or two ahead of starvation and mutual destruction. And maybe we can manage to be four jumps ahead or five jumps ahead rather than just the usual one or two jumps. You know, Gibbon once observed that history is chiefly a register of the crimes, follies, and misfortunes of mankind. And starting accepting that as a premise, I'd like to have one place where for once we don't have a folly and don't have a misfortune. Just fingers crossed. And see if we can't get off to a slightly better start. I do think it is reasonable to hope, not for ultimate solutions, but that you can start on a course which is a little bit better rather than a little bit worse. I happen to think that there's a tremendous difference between a little bit better and a little bit worse.
Thank you very much, Professor Shaw.
Cambridge Forum has presented Can NATO Defend Europe? Featuring Milton Katz. An audio cassette of this program is available by sending $7 with your request to Cambridge Forum, 3 Church Street, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02138. Cambridge Forum is a program of the Social Responsibility Committee of the First Parish in Cambridge under the direction of Reverend Herbert Vedder. It is co-sponsored by the Lowell Institute, the MIT Chaplains, and United Ministry at Harvard and Radcliffe. This forum was produced by David LaValle in association with WGBH Boston. Broadcast of Cambridge Forum is made possible in part by the Unitarian Universalist Congregations of North America.
You're listening to KUAC-FM in Fairbanks. It's 1 minute before 7 o'clock. Just a reminder that this weekend we change to Yukon Daylight Time. Don't forget to set your clocks ahead 1 hour on tonight when you go to bed. This Sunday afternoon from 4 to 6 p.m., KUAC-FM and TV will present a live simulcast of the Fairbanks Symphony final performance of the season. The concert will feature the world premiere of the 1984 Overture, a festive new work written by Gordon Wright to celebrate the 25th anniversary of Alaskan statehood. Tune your stereo to FM 105 and set your TV dial to KUAC Channel 9 to enjoy the sight and sound of the Fairbanks Symphony in the comforts of your own home, this Sunday, 4 to 6 p.m. on KUAC FM and TV. Well, it's time for the Home Fires Radio Show with Patty Kostelic.
Good evening. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic, and with me in the studio this evening is Father Loyens. Before we begin, I would just like to say for my regular listeners that if you haven't been to Creamer's Field in the last few days, I would urge you to do so. The birds are absolutely here in incredible numbers. Have you seen?
Yes.
Have you been by?
I just drove by.
Sandhill cranes, an incredible variety of birds, and they're just beautiful, and they're circling, practicing flying, and so on. And they're very close to the road right now, so for any of you who don't realize that or haven't happened to pass by, I really encourage you to stop by Creamer's in the next couple of days. I'm going to let my guest introduce himself in a second. Our topic, in the interest of the papal visit, is going to be the history of the papacy. And, of course, we can go other directions from there. But would you tell us how you came to Fairbanks and a little bit about your background?
Well, the first time I came to Fairbanks was in 1955, after I had been teaching 2 years down at Holy Cross, where I started a high school in 1953, the first high school on the Yukon River in the history of the world.
My goodness, well, you were sent by the church?
Yes, we started a high school at Holy Cross, and it's that high school that 3 years later moved over to Copper Valley in the Glen Ellen area. I'm sure that many of our listeners are familiar with the Copper Valley School. Anyway, that brought me to Alaska in 1953.
Where did you come from?
Well, I had been studying in the United States for 3 years, but I was born in Belgium. And I came to the United States with the intention of going to Alaska. I was captivated by Alaska.
What did you hear about it in Belgium?
Mostly reading. Reading, I don't know if you're familiar with the Belgian school system, but the Belgian school system is, you know, 6 years, 4 year high school, 2 year college combined into a 6 year course. And each year in the older system, works, say, along the line of the first year would be, say, strictly grammar. Second year would be syntax. The third year would be narrative. Fourth year would be something else. Then you get to poetry. Then you get, you know, to the rhetoric. So it's the old kind of Latin system yet. And so each class, which was a master classroom with a master teacher, would have a library of its own. So in that third year, the topic was narrative. And we studied narrative in Latin and Greek and French and Dutch and English and German, the six obligatory languages. And I read all these books about Alaska and became very fascinated with Alaska and pursued this, and here I am.
It's an exotic location to go from Belgium, which is very civilized and very settled.
Yes, and very small and very
populous,
dense, and you know, so forth. So it had a tradition of emigration, you know, very much so, all over the world. Anyway, so that's what brought me to Alaska. I came back then to Alaska in 1960, where I was teaching high school here, Monroe High School, in town, and at the same time working for my master's in education here at the University of Alaska. Then in 62, I was asked to begin work on a doctor's degree in anthropology, cultural anthropology. So I moved to Stevens Hall here on the campus and lived in Stevens Hall for a year. And then in 63, I went to the University of Wisconsin, finished my doctorate, and came back and began teaching here at the university from 66 until 74, where I was, you know, in the Department of Anthropology and was chairperson of the department for several years. And then I was appointed to Jesuit. I'm a Jesuit priest. I was appointed to Jesuit administration. And then in 76, I was appointed to administration of the whole Oregon province, as we call it, which is Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, and Alaska. Then in 80, I got sick, so I resigned my office and came back to Fairbanks to recuperate, where I promptly got tired of sitting around and began to teach.
Well, you look very well.
I feel well.
You seem very
so
recovered.
The last 3.5 years, I've been doing adult education here in Fairbanks, theology, scripture, but in a kind of a wider context of cultural anthropology. And so I really enjoy it here.
Certainly an expert on the subject that we're going to discuss tonight. But you've piqued my curiosity. Tell me a little bit about what it was like to start Holy Cross.
In 1953, Holy Cross was a small community, about 250 Indian Eskimo people, because it is at the area where the Eskimo, the Yupik area, kind of merges into the Ingalik Indian area. And at the same time, we had a boarding school there, which was started in the 1880s. Late 1880s, and there had always been this desire of shifting that over into a high school, that is to say, part of it. So I began with 10 students the first year, and it was exciting because I was teaching 5 subjects.
Kept you on your toes.
And but then, you know, wasn't all that bad. And of course, in many ways, conditions were quite primitive yet, because the supplies came once a year with the boat. We had, of course, airmail service at that time, but those were, you know, the small planes coming out of McGrath and so forth. There was really no landing field, and summer they landed on the river, and winter they landed on the sandbar, all that sort of thing. So, yeah, it was an exciting time, but it was a fun time, really.
Building things from the ground up.
Getting
things
going, yeah.
All right, to our subject. I don't suppose there's anyone in Fairbanks who hasn't noticed that the Pope is coming on Tuesday. he really would have had to have been in total hibernation in order to not know. I thought for the benefit of our audience, I myself am just, have to admit, woeful ignorance in terms of theological history. I don't even know the beginnings of the Catholic Church, and so I would sort of like you to talk about the beginnings of the papacy. Just give us a little historical context, because it's not just the person, it's the office, and there's a good part of the world that has Catholicism as their religion.
All right. Well, I suppose you have to start it in Palestine, and you have to start it with a person called Jesus, who was a Jew, and as such, of course, shared the views, the geography, the culture, the bigotries, and so forth, of his time, of his people. The interesting thing was, of course, that he came from the Jewish people, who had a lengthy historical or lengthy religious history, which they, of course, had put down in a number of writings, which were well-known and so forth, and which, according to their belief, pointed to the coming of a Messiah, which was expected at the time. The expectations were somewhat muddled and had become, for various reasons, rather politicized. Nevertheless, he stepped forward and began to teach the fact that he was the Messiah. Well, in the course of his teaching also, of course, he began to show and maintain that he was more than a man, that he was a God-man, as a matter of fact. Anyway, the fact that he committed himself to history and to a people and to a local situation and to a cultural, historical, and political situation, his life ended in death, a violent death. Most people's lives end in death, but in a violent death. Well, before his death, of course, he called a group of people together. Say, let's call them a rather fragile fellowship. I call them fragile because they, too, were children of their time. They, too, shared language, history, culture, insights, bigotries. But they were a fellowship in the sense that their fellowship was based on their belief in him. That is to say, while he was alive, they were captivated and fascinated by him. Then when he died and manifested himself after his death to them as alive, they came alive, as a matter of fact, and they began to exploit, say, the matrices of universalism that were within his teaching. And very quickly they found themselves going beyond the Palestinian area into Syria and so forth. And they began to preach that this man, who was God as well as man, was the final gift of salvation, that anyone who was looking for salvation had somehow or other to become associated with him, to undergo in some mystical fashion his fundamental experience of death and resurrection. And they said that was available to people through baptism. So they began to teach, and they began to spread. They began to go into the world and through baptism and confirmation said, look, here is this possibility for you to enter into the salvational experience. You can nurture and strengthen that life through the Eucharist. We bring you healing, forgiveness, compassion through the sacrament of reconciliation. We also sanctify and sanctify the various moments as well as the duration of life and death through the sacraments of matrimony, sacrament of order, the sacrament of the sick, and so forth. So in this context, they went out and they began to form this fragile fellowship, which very quickly spread into the Hellenistic area. In other words, the Greco-Roman Empire, the Greek-speaking world. Paul was, of course, extremely important in this whole process. Anyway, by the end of the first century, let us say, that fellowship, still fragile, it will always remain fragile, that group of people needed and saw the need of organization.
Because up until this time, they did not have a formal organization. And did they all agree on what the truth was or what to emphasize or...
They had already by then, even in the middle of the century, there was evidence of, you know, of organization. There was recognition of the 12 early followers, the apostles, as we call them, as kind of prime witnesses, as well as people who could interpret and so forth. Even by the year 49, there was already a council. They came together to settle certain disputes, but there was not by any means uniformity. In other words, pluralism, pluralism was within the matrix of Christianity from the very beginning. There were, of course, already some severe crises in this sense that Christianity, coming out of a Jewish world, had the colorings and the makings and, the connotations of Judaism. And yet somehow or other, by analyzing and reflecting on itself, it began to realize that there were contradictions. They had to break out of this. did Christians have to come through the vestibule of Judaism to become Christians? That was the burning question of the middle century. Well, they solved that by saying no. In other words, by saying, look, the freedom of Christianity is precisely that it's open to all, that that somehow or other they managed to bring these, what they call the gifts of salvation, the gift of Jesus, really, to anyone without regard of race, color, creed, you know, prior belief, and so forth. So obviously they broke out of the Jewish matrix, and Paul was extremely important in that. So by the end of the century, it was clear that as the apostolic witnesses were dying off, you know, they had to think in terms of continuity, continuation, succession, and so forth. So that by the end of the first century, it's clear that there is already emerging a form of governance within these various local communities that had been established. And even by the year 65, they were in Rome, they were in Athens, they were in, you know, Thessalonica, in Corinth, they were in Ephesus, they were, you know, all over the, basically the Roman Empire at the time. So we begin by then already to see the establishment of the churches under the unification, under the kind of spiritual leadership, under the authority, if you want to put it, of a local bishop, an episkopos in Greek, an overseer. There were some variants, you know, in that particular form, in that particular format, but basically that's what it began to be. Well, from the very beginning, there was a clear understanding that Christ had in some special way designated Peter as kind of the head of this college, this group, this fellowship. Well, as Peter moved from Jerusalem to Antioch and then to Rome, his office traveled with him, let's put it that way. And very quickly we begin to see that in the second, and of course now we enter into the whole period of persecutions where the Roman Empire, because of its insistence on the divinization of the emperors and emperor worship and so forth, began to very strongly persecute the Christians. Anyway, as questions came up and as disputes arose and so forth, there was more and more looking to the chair of Rome, to the bishop of Rome, to settle some of these disputes. When you begin to see, and that, of course, is the beginning of the papacy, really. As you begin to see this, you have to see it in terms of kind of looking for a genealogy. Mm-hmm. We should be able to understand that today in our search for roots. Mm-hmm. They were looking for a genealogy both of truth as well as a genealogy, say, of importance or of locality, let's put it that way. In other words, Peter was the important person. So where Peter was, there was, of course, an important situation. So the successors of Peter established this genealogy of, say, of importance or of a kind of a primacy, if you want to put it that way. But there was also the whole importance of the genealogy of truth. Where would you look if you had a dispute? And more they began to look to the See of Rome because of its importance and because of the fact that, say, deviant teachings or whatever were springing up here and there. Rome somehow or other managed to keep itself free. And so Rome gained, it had, let's put it this way, it had a good genealogy, mm-hmm. a genealogy of truth as well as a genealogy of, you know, of importance throughout the centuries. So during some of these early disputes, and there were some severe ones in the early church, I have to keep my earlier words in mind. It was started as a fragile fellowship, and that is the best nature of it, seems to me. Later on, the church will, you know, say, use other terms, but basically that's what it is. So that by the time you get to, say, to the beginning of the 4th century, of course, the Roman Empire, you know, which had once been one and is now beginning to break into the East and West and so forth. Anyway, Christianity, which had for several centuries now been kind of a suppressed minority, now is accepted as a state religion under Constantine, the Emperor Constantine. So Christianity now gets imperial blessings, if you want to put it that way. And so they become the official religion of the Roman Empire. At least they have the official sanction. They're no longer persecuted. You know, they can exist. By now, they had, of course, developed some rather important people in terms of thinking, in terms of philosophy, in terms of apologetics, meaning a defense of the faith and so forth. So by the time you get to the 4th century, Christianity has arrived, if you want to put it that way, in the Greco-Roman world.
Was that transition from the previous Roman beliefs a difficult one?
No, I think that by then Christianity had grown tremendously in numbers, and that's one of the remarkable phenomena of history, that this particular belief that these people said, look, here is this man who was born here and so forth, who demonstrated his divinity, whom we believe to be alive today, and who has given us, an opportunity for salvation, that so many millions of people really in such a short span of time committed themselves to this and were capable of sticking with it clear through, death and persecution and everything else. But I think we tend to have forgotten today, or we don't experience, I think, today as much what the freedom of the freeing effect of this particular new way, as they called it, would mean in that particular time. In terms of, it's hard for us to think back to the second century and try to imagine the conditions. The millions of slaves, the incredibly rich families. Well, we can if we take, say, some analogies from the third world today, maybe. Mm-hmm. They're not slaves in the sense of having no personal freedom, but they're slaves in the sense of an economic system or capitalism, mm-hmm. or whatever you want to call it. So in that sense, I think
power and money concentrated in the hands of a very
few
and very
also the incredible luxury, say, of Rome and of, and at the same time, political subjugation, exploitation, taxation, a lot of that stuff going on. And those people, I think, in a sense, saw that group of early Christians who, can, in a sense, lived liberation. I mean, they were people who tried to break down these existing barriers. There was no recognition of race, color, or creed. They welcomed everybody. They loved one another. If there's one thing that comes out of the early documents, is that they tried to practice what they preached. Well, for many people, that was an incredibly attractive new approach to life. Mm-hmm. So they flocked in, and especially the lower classes, and in this case, very often the slaves.
Right.
But you also have to realize that practically all the education in the Greco-Roman world was done by Greek slaves. I mean, if a Roman wanted to be educated, he had to get a Greek educated. The Romans were great on road building and bridges, and they were great engineers, great administrators.
But not
great
scholars.
But they were, not really in the sense of the Greeks. So that as more and more of those people became Christian, Christianity really gained in stature. I suppose if you would really analyze all the motives that would be behind a move like Constantine's, I would dare say that the emperor needed Christianity as much as Christianity needed the emperor, and that we can demonstrate many times in the history of the world,
right.
since Christ.
Of church and of government.
Yes,
right.
Including, I think, our present emperor who, one could make some very fascinating comparisons. The point is that Christianity now gained legal status, if you want to put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, very quickly, within a couple hundred years, the Roman Empire fell totally apart.
Right.
We have the invasions of the what we, from our exalted ethnocentric position, call barbarians.
Right.
The Vandals and the Visigoths, mm-hmm. and the Ostrogoths and the Lombards and so forth. And including my own ancestors in Gaul, they're supposedly all barbarians in those days.
Right, most of us descend from
Yes. So all our ancestors were called barbarians. The point is, you see, they had been at the fringe of the Roman Empire, nibbling at it for hundreds of years, and Rome valiantly tried to keep them, out. Well, now, because they were definitely desirous of all the things that the Roman Empire represented. There was luxury, there was a different standard of living, there was education, there was a unified language, Latin, there was, there were buildings and there was all kinds of things, the amenities of life. So these people were waiting to get in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as the Roman Empire began to crumble, they rushed in. With the effect that the Roman Empire collapsed, well, as it collapsed, there was the church ready to take over all kinds of activities that the Roman Empire before had done.
Had combined in
yes,
the political
power,
right?
The education, for instance. A lot of the what we would call today the social services, coupled with the fact that the church, also taught or preached a salvation way, a way of improving this kind of whole situation. Anyway, within a very short order, we see the church turning these so-called barbarians into Christian gentlemen. And, of course, then you get into what we also very, very ethnocentrically call the Dark Ages, because we don't know all that much about them. We call them dark.
Before we get into that, could we back up a little bit? What kind of documentation survives from, say, the first century? I mean, actual documentation that...
Well, from the first century, you're speaking now in terms of Christian documents.
Yes, yeah.
Because of the non-Christian documents, we don't have all that much. They survive from even before the Jewish scriptures, and they were before 1947-48 reconstructed from all kinds of ways. But then we had the famous Dead Sea Scroll discovery, where we found scraps as well as a complete manuscript of the Book of Isaiah. So that was the book the Christians. The early Christians were Jewish. Mm-hmm. So that's what they brought into Christianity, since they saw themselves as the continuation and the fulfillment of that particular religious movement, Judaism. We have that. There's no doubt about this. When we get to the New Testament, in terms of actual manuscriptural evidence, that comes again from around 1947, and from a number of others. 1947 refers to the famous discovery of the Gnostic kind of library at ancient Senebaskion, the place we call the Nag Hammadi. It's on the Nile in Egypt, where a number of documents were discovered, and where, of course, we have a good bit of Coptic and Greek and other evidence. But what we also have is that a number of people were referring in their writings and so forth, say, take Bishop Ignatius of Antioch, around the year 115, who was being martyred by the Romans, but on his way to Rome, sort of had a triumphal kind of a trip around the Mediterranean. And as he was going everywhere, he wrote letters to the various churches, encouraging them and so forth. And he was quoting scripture, so you have that. So I would say that we have a rather incredible amount of well-researched and well-documented material going back even to, say, to the late first century. With, of course, also the fact that the scriptures, what we call today the New Testament, has perdured, and of that is, I don't think there's any book anywhere that has been researched, that has been studied, that has been gone over, and compared with any possible scrap of evidence to come to a pretty good conclusion today, and a quite safe conclusion, seems to me, that what we call today, say, the Greek New Testament is indeed pretty well just the way it was written. There's no doubt about this. So let's go back to what we call the Dark Ages. Well, in the meantime, of course, as the church became more and more identified with the Roman Empire, and of course as the Bishop of Rome, became more and more important, and as the church, being a child of its time, began to take on royal trappings and imperial trappings and so forth, the church now finds itself kind of the civilizer of that new world that is in the making, which is, the reconstitution of the Roman Empire into the new, eventually budding nations. And so we find the church now going out and, as a matter of fact, evangelizing, Christianizing, the church being a child of its time, sometimes used the secular arm as well as the spiritual arm, say, until you get to about 800, not about, exactly 800, and there you have now the fact that the Bishop of Rome, by then called Pope, a term or a title that had been used pretty well for priests and bishops, everywhere, but it became slowly sort of reserved for him, where he now puts the crown on Charlemagne, you know, the famous Frankish emperor, who I'm sure was pretty nonplussed by the whole affair, but who at the same time, I think, got a different message. You may represent the temporal power, but we are over you. So anyway, that's how you get into the 9th century, you know, beyond 800. Well, as you know from your regular history, at the death of Charlemagne, that great empire sort of fell apart, you know, under his three sons and so forth. Well, what began to develop is that there was a new attitude, which was that the papacy slowly begins to be more and more powerful. At the same time, we enter into the whole Middle Ages complex, feudalism, association with, you know, with landed territories, manors and castles and feudal relationships between kings and knights and all that sort of thing. And the papacy and the bishops were not immune to this whole operation. So you find yourself going into that situation where now you have popes who begin to really exert power. I would say that's where you really begin to see the kind of powerful papacy developing.
The church is becoming wealthy at this point, too.
If you wealthy in the sense of throughout what was then Christendom, you have to realize a very important fact here is that Christianity in 200 covered more area than it did in 700 or 800. Because, you see, I haven't said a word about this, but you don't forget you have the whole business of Islam.
Oh, right.
You know, so there's I'm skipping over some important factors here, because by now, by 800, let's say, you know, you have Islam in southern France, all of North Africa, through Egypt, around the coast, up into Constantinople and so forth. You have a totally different situation here where Christians in those areas are struggling, if not going under. So by now, Christianity has been kind of pushed together on the northern part of the Mediterranean. You know, it's Italy and it's Greece and it's some of the Balkans and it's, Germany and it's France and it's England and so forth.
In area, it's been reduced. Has it also been reduced in terms of numbers of believers at this point?
Oh, I'm sure that most probably balanced itself off, because as they lost in terms of the southern Mediterranean, eastern Mediterranean littoral, they moved into, you know, Frankenland became Catholic, you know, Spain became Catholic. They got into, you know, into Holland, Belgium, mm-hmm. Friesland, Germany, because you see what also has happened. You know, we can't track all the deals here, but the Pope Gregory is the one who sent the famous Augustine of Canterbury to England with his monks, you know, to Christianize England. And pretty soon, and of course, out of that came St. Patrick and so forth. Anyway, out of that, pretty soon you have the fact that these Anglo-Saxon monks are coming back to the continent, out of one of them being Bishop Boniface, you know, the famous apostle of Germany. And so there are, you know, all kind of movements going on here. But the point is, you see, that that there is actually a very fascinating thing to consider at this point, because since these people were being Christianized, the northern countries, let's say, the northwestern European countries, since they were being Christianized by monks, and in the meantime we get the whole monastic movement going, who came from Rome and who had allegiance to Rome, that's the kind of allegiance they taught to their people. You have to see that as a factor also in terms of what the papacy will be able to do. Because very quickly, the papacy, in a sense, kind of tries to reconstitute the Roman Empire, but now it becomes the Holy Roman Empire. See, with the German emperors and so forth. And so the papacy from now on will have some pretty strong influence, as well as an explicit right of meddling, if you want to put it that way, in the socio-political affairs of all those countries, and that will go on for a number of years.
Are there at this point occurring some groups of people who are calling themselves Christians or are believers in Christ who are in disagreement with the papacy at certain points, or is it fairly unified at this point?
Well, there have always been certain dissidents, let's put it that way, or people who deviated. It starts already in the 2nd century, the famous Donatist situation. Of course, in the 3rd and 4th centuries, you had the famous Arian disputes which arose from the fact that they taught that Christ was, you know, that Jesus was a man only. Mm-hmm. You know, and that spread through a fair part of the Roman Empire, and it is, as a matter of fact, in terms of, say, the history of Christian dogma or Christian beliefs, it is precisely in the debates between the bishops who came together in groups because they felt collegially responsible for the whole Christian body, mm-hmm. that they refined those particular points, and that it's out of that slowly what we call the Nicene Creed developed. You know, where these points would be hammered out, and of course, which also resulted in the fact that that was formulated in the language of the time, which was basically Greek, you know, and so forth. So all of that is going on at this particular time. So there were obviously some people who had dissented, but I would think, say, during the Middle Ages, you can pretty well say that, except for some very few occasional sporadic kind of outbursts. There was basically it was a Christian world, let's put it that way, and that is basically how they went into the Middle Ages. And I would say that that any historian would have to say that it was Christianity or it was the Church. There was only one. Mm-hmm. That and of course Catholic means universal, so they call right. themselves Catholic because right. they were universal. They were the ones that really saved whatever good there was in the ancient world in terms of their copying, the monastic. They also, in a sense, brought new agricultural methodologies to Europe because these great monastic, these monasteries began to deforestate, Germany. They began to cultivate. They brought management. All of that still, that perduance of that Roman genius that was still at work. With at the same time, say that heritage of Greek scholarship and so forth, all of that, and all your medieval universities will come out of that, the great University of Paris and so forth.
Maintaining the libraries, keeping the manuscripts in order, all the copying and.
And then by that time, also you have to realize that you now have the rediscovery of a lot of classical, by this we mean Greek and Roman. Authors through the Arabs, through Spain, so that now some of the great Greeks, like say Plato, Aristotle, all those characters find their way now into the European universities of Paris, of Louvain, of Cologne, and so forth. Anyway, there is a ferment going on during this particular time. I would say the papacy was riding high. Then you get into the eras where the papacy really began to decline. Because, you see, as slowly nationalism began to grow, because these countries are beginning to fall apart, they begin to assert their own, say, national as well as ethnic identities. They also begin to assert their own viewpoints and, you know, variances and so forth. And so then we get into what is known as the Great Schism, with one pope living in Avignon. I'm sure you've heard of that,
Avignon captivity.
Yes, the Avignon captivity, which,
could,
of course,
could you
was,
tell us a little bit about that? Because they're probably...
Well, what it basically came down to is that you had, of course, by now, some of these emperors and so forth, who weren't all that keen on, you know, on the influence that was being asserted. Because during the Middle Ages, the Church, of course, also... developed a modus vivendi, you know, way of living with the medieval society, which resulted in the fact that as you had these kings and counts and knights and manors and feudal setups and so forth, they began more and more to assert their right to invest the bishops, you know, with their episcopacy and so forth, and with their fief, if you want to call it that, which resulted, of course, in their being beholden to king or to count or to this and that. So you had that whole situation developing. Well, all of that resulted finally in the fact that there were so many opposing powers pulling in various directions that you came up with rival candidates, and bingo, there we had two.
Okay. Just how the first, how were they choosing the popes during this earlier time? There was group of cardinals? I mean, not at this early time.
We don't get to the cardinals until about the late 900s or so, even later than that.
Okay, so in the early days, people...
In the early days, bishops, and of course the pope is a bishop of Rome, bishops were basically selected by the clergy and the people of his diocese, of his area, of his church, his community, his faith community. And they did that sometimes by spontaneous acclamation. Sometimes there was somewhat of a process, but it was basically a papal election on the part of the community. It was fairly democratic. While that slowly begins, as you move into the imperial days, then you begin to see emperors who want to have something to say over it, mm-hmm. who might not want...
They want to vote, too.
X or Y in a certain place because, he doesn't quite have the imperial policy at heart. So they begin to mix in it. Then these kings and German kings and French kings and so forth begin to get into the act. So pretty quickly, it becomes a matter of the nobility or the aristocracy rather than the common people. So slowly it gets to be moved up. And so the episcopal as well as papal elections begin to be more and more, the prerogative, say, of the few.
Political.
Still quite a few, but still the few. Well, it's precisely there where you have to see the possibility, of course, of the papacy being beholden to, say, the king, or the king being beholden to the papacy. Well, when that began to be, say, preponderant, that's when you get your rival or opposite, candidates. And so what we find is that because of political alliances, say, because of the fact that the French king supported one candidate who was not welcome in Italy, well, he packed up and went to Avignon. In the meantime, they created their own. And at some time, we had three even. And that lasted for a number of years, of course, the so-called, they called it captivity, uh-huh. because they claimed they were, not free to go to Rome. The Pope need not be in Rome, of course. Peter was the leader of the church while he was in Jerusalem, while he was in Antioch, while he was later in Rome, which means that historically speaking, at least, the Pope need not be elected by a college of cardinals. He need not be living, in Rome and so forth. But historically speaking, that's how it has developed. So anyway, even after the Avignon mess was cleared up and so forth, and you realize, of course, that as you have these situations, there will be theologizing going on, meaning theological underpinnings for various positions will be created. Which lead to a theory we call conciliarism, whether or not the pope is over a council of the bishops, whether a council is over a pope. In other words, could a council and councils try to depose some of those opposing characters, to straighten out the mess? Well, then we finally got it straightened out. And by then you're in the 14th century, of course. But you see, by then there have a number of precedents have been set, obviously. There's been a certain amount of association with temporal power. There has been this strong effort on the papacy to control temporal power, not always succeeding, but at least enunciating the premise constantly. Anyway, by the time that you get to the 14th century, and we finally get the mess cleared up, and we have a clear-cut proper successor of the Bishop of Rome, in Rome and so forth, then we come to the end of the Middle Ages, and we're heading towards the Renaissance, and we are really, in many ways, in kind of a sad state of affairs within Christianity, in terms of low level of Christian living, a number of abuses, problems with celibacy, which is another topic that one could trace through the history of the church. We still have the whole business of selling, or at least of bribing offices, the whole business of the inmixing yet of princes and kings and royalty and all kinds of characters, to the point that comes the 16th century. We have such a clamor for reform in the church on the part of you know, all kinds of good Christians, Catholics. I mean, there were only one kind, so good Christians. I'm not speaking of the Eastern Bloc, right, because the Eastern Bloc has by now broken away, you know, since 1054. I'm speaking of the West. That there is such a cry for reformation, for reform of head and body, as it was called. That was the great slogan of the time. In other words, the papacy needed reforming and the body needed reforming. That, well, it finally breaks loose, and we have Martin Luther, you know, a Catholic priest who really tried to do something about it, who was scandalized by a number of abuses and so forth. Martin Luther, who meant very well, who was not out to, you know, to break away, set out to reform, gets himself cornered, you know, and you know what happens when two antagonists get into a corner, there's no longer talking, they're shouting. So anyway, that leads to the, you know, to the it's Protestant revolt, as it is called, or the Reformation. Of course, then you have, even within their ranks, considerable disunity, because you have Calvin and you have Melanchthon and you have all the other reformers. And before you know it, you have a major part of the Catholic Church now broken away, you know, from the main body. That, of course, leads now to a period of very defensive Catholicism. You know, the best analogy that I keep coming up with in class is the analogy of the wagon train. You know, when the wagon train is in pretty good territory, they go strung out and so forth, and everything goes well, and they are pretty well on a pilgrimage. They don't quite know just where it is, but they got a vague idea, and they got leaders, things go well, and they meet at night. But when there is a hostile attack, they draw the wagons in a circle, and they start potting away at anyone on the outside. Well, anyway, the reform is then countered by the church. That is called the Counter-Reformation. In the meantime, of course, again, you know, leaving big chunks of history aside, you have, of course, the development of not just the monasticism, which I mentioned earlier, but you have now the friars, you have the Dominicans, you have the Franciscans, you have a much more intense kind of teaching of the laity, you know, which had been neglected, really, in the late Middle Ages. That leads then to a whole effort of counter-reformation. Well, the counter-reformation, of course, was primarily a defensive stand, but at the same time a stand to go out and reconquer. There was really very little reconquering going on in Europe itself. You know, Germany was by now divided into a Protestant and a Catholic situation. What Luther had fought, the Lutheran Church fell heir to, it too became identified with the political arm and with the princes and so forth and so forth. So by the time you get to the 16th century, you not only have that, you also have, of course, a totally new kind of mentality sweeping through the world meaning here the Western world. But we also have to realize that now the world is opening up. We have the great voyages of discovery. You know,
The church went as well as the
and
state.
And the church, since the church always had that kind of urge, that missionizing, you know, kind of urge, really, that they had received from Jesus and that had been with them from the very early centuries, they went, and now they had all these unsuspecting characters to work with, you see, which was different from these Lutherans and so forth in Europe. So they zoomed all over the world, and, you know, you have now the beginning of the great missionary effort of the church.
But back to the papacy.
Yeah.
At this point, is it a very strong, controlling, authoritarian...
Well, at this point, it's the Renaissance papacy.
Right.
And they are, I would say, fairly... a group of fairly unedifying, if not disedifying, characters.
Uh-huh.
Because this is way into the Borgias and some of the, you know, rather... In other words, they were refined gentlemen, patrons of the art, not really all that keen on some of the reform that the Council of Trent, you know, in the late 1500s had come up with. But the cry for reform was so strong that eventually it will get to them, because, you see, you barely get into, you know, out of the 16th century... and the Renaissance, which was basically harking back to, you know, to the rediscovery of the classical age, the Greco-Roman literature, the mentality. You know, you shift from a theocentric universe to an anthropocentric universe. Man becomes the center of things. We also, of course, now get to the age where you shift from a heliocentric universe to a geocentric universe. You know, things are really, there's a lot of things in the air. But by the time you get to the 17th century and more, you now get this whole Enlightenment and all kinds of things are happening. So it's a new world that's really creating. And nationalism is now really rampant. You know, these nations are no longer just simply loose ideas. They are now, France is really thinking as France. And, you know, they're becoming the nationalism
in there.
So that period, really, the papacy is not all that effective. They were effective in this sense that they were sending out people that created everywhere they went papal affiliation and papal loyalty. That is to say, loyalty to Rome. You know, in the New World, and you know, wherever they went, in China, and you know, in Japan.
By then, at least the lineage in modern day we associate. Very much. I mean, it was a historic event when a pope was non-Italian.
Definitely. But you see, even in the in the former ages, we had many non-Italians. Even in 4 years, sure, that was quite common that it was not an Italian.
So it's only the last couple of hundred years.
Yes, that it became very Italianate. And so what you have to see now is, you see, let's move on a bit, and you see, we get to the French Revolution, let's say, 1789, the great, you know, liberté, égalité, fraternité, and so forth. Well, it turned out to be a fizzle. The result of that is, of course, that by the time we get to, you know, to the 1800s, liberalism and all that kind of stuff is a bad word. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with the fall of Napoleon and Waterloo and, you know, and the Congress of Vienna in 1815, everything was now back to monarchy. Back to save stuff, you know, unionism and all that, which is not really being used yet, but there were all these movements floating around. They were all taboo. Well, the papacy followed. Children of their time, they also were therefore in favor of monarchy, in favor of conservatism, in favor of, the powers that repress, if you want to put it that way, all these particular forms of, you know, of liberalism. With the result that now you begin slowly to develop, you know, a monarchical papacy, autocratic, you know, really, really laying down, you know, the law. In other words, slowly beginning to form what we, until 25 years ago, were familiar with in the papacy. And that will go into the, you know, through the 18th century, you know, because by the time you get to the late, 1800s and so forth, you have some great popes like Leo the 13th, you know, who's the one who really kind of laid the charter for Christian or at least Catholic unionism, labor movement, you know, in his famous encyclicals. But basically, it was a time when we were not taking any liberties at all, where the church allied itself with the forces of conservatism. Monarchy was the right thing to do and so forth. So that is the model the papacy developed. So the papacy became more and more monarchical, more and more, autocratic, if you want to put it that way. Now, by now, the principle had long been established that the Bishop of Rome, as a successor of Peter and so forth, was elected by a group of cardinals. That had now been several hundred years. So the popes of the 20th century, you know, say from Leo the 13th, Pius the 9th, you know, so forth, 10th, 11th, 12th, Paul the 6th, changing. Those were basically the princes of the church, if you want to put it that way. They were deeply convinced that they were, you know, the successors to Peter, no problem with that. By now, of course, they'd also developed the idea that they were the vicar of Christ. That, you know, theologically there's no problem with that either, but that can get into a triumphalistic kind of, monarchical deal. So anyway, the modern papacy that we have known was a papacy that had drawn unto itself pretty well total control. The church as a fragile kind of a fellowship of local churches united in charity, and I mean with the Bishop of Rome and with the Vicar of Peter and the Vicar of Christ, and who ruled, say, with charity and love, and was the symbol of unity and so forth. That had slowly shifted into a monarchical kind of model of that he was in charge, that he appointed all bishops. You know, in other words, mm-hmm. everything mm-hmm. flowed from Rome and everything flowed to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically how we went into the middle of the of our own century. And then, of course, came the great disillusionment of the modern world, in the Second World War, where we began mm-hmm. to realize that if mankind can do its thing, mankind will do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that there was still a great need for salvation and for, a different thing. Anyway, the point is that we come to the Second Vatican Council. And when these 2,500 bishops of the whole world came together and looked and said, what can we do to bring Christianity into the modern world? They also said that there is a great redefinition necessary. And so instead of speaking of the church sort of as a hierarchical structure and so forth, they defined the church as a pilgrim people on the way to the Lord. Pilgrim people, of course, need organization, but they don't need a high-handed kind of autocratic.
So it gives a little more autonomy to the churches now, in fact.
The Vatican Council really saw the church, as I say, first of all, they used a number of analogies. But one which I particularly like is that they speak of a universal communion of local churches united to each other through the bond of charity and united through their spiritual head, the Holy Father, the Pope, and who therefore who shares with all these local churches ruled by a bishop or governed by a bishop or led by a bishop, which is a much better mm-hmm. word, because the emphasis today is much more pastoral rather than jurisdictional and authoritative, that therefore we begin to see today, and we experience also, I think, today, our spiritual leader, not so much as an autocrat who dictates, but as a leader, a pastoral leader, a leader, who promotes union, who is a visible sign of unity, and who through his colleagues in the College of Bishops allows these local churches to reach their autonomy, their identity, their language in terms of the liturgy, their expressions of faith, of worship, and so mm-hmm. forth. And that's where we are today.
The vast majority of Catholics, I believe, are in third world countries. Or not,
well be right, yes, if you speak of
numbers.
Latin America, mm-hmm. Africa, India.
Do you think there's a possibility that there will be a third world pope at some...
Well, we have a number of third world bishops, obviously, a large number of third world bishops, and we have a number of third world
so-called
cardinals.
Third world.
And, of course, most people would have been very surprised 20 years ago to say that we were going to have... say an Eastern Bloc pope. So, the next one, maybe not, but it wouldn't surprise me that, it doesn't surprise me at all. I expect that sooner or later we'll have an outstanding person that mm-hmm. That comes from that area, because you have to realize that Western European Christianity is not all that alive. And in numbers, of course, they've gone down.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean just simply Catholics, but the population has gone down.
Right.
We are, in a sense, being outgrown by the population explosion of the third world, so that more and more bishops will come from those areas. The agenda will more and more be determined by their view of what the mm-hmm. church is, what the church needs, what the church ought to be in the new world. And so it's inevitable, it seems to me, that eventually there will be someone mm-hmm. who has the insight and the capabilities from that area to lead the church.
I can't resist asking you this question. We're almost out of time here. Was there a Pope Joan?
There is a legend of a Popus Joan.
A Popus?
It's a Popus, yes. And the legend even has been put into a movie. And, of course, you ought to judge the movie more for its artistic capabilities than for its, historical reliability. To the best of my own personal, say, knowledge, there was never, such a person. I think the best explanation most probably is that if you abbreviate in Latin Joannes, Joannes, and you abbreviate it Joan, then you have at least, say, a linguistic possibility for this. Her existence was, according to the legend, was presumably discovered only when she came to childbirth during a religious procession. I don't think she would have been that stupid. Anyway, so the whole thing, I think, is kind of a quaint legend. There were some very interesting women, of course, in the early church, in terms of deacons, deaconesses and so forth. There were some very, very powerful abbesses, of monasteries of nuns who wore the ring, who wore the pectoral cross, and who wore the mitre, and who did some real ordering around of the clergy under them. But it is very much of a disputed point whether or not ordination, that is to say, the conferring of orders, was ever done to a woman in the church.
There's great pressure now. Do you think we'll have women priests soon? They have increasing power in the service.
Not soon. Not soon.
Not
but
soon.
It is both my belief as well as my hope that that will come. Yes, I think that as we begin to realize more and more that the church is a group of people whose gifts and charisms and talents all need to be used and utilized and put into harness, if you want to put it that way, for the common good of all, then I cannot see, also given the temper of the times, because we remain children of our times, that this will eventually come.
That point is clear this evening, that the church is always reflecting its times. I thank you very much, Father Loynes, for being with us this evening. I hope to talk to all of you again next week after we've had this famous visit. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.
You're listening to KUAC-FM in Fairbanks. It's 8 o'clock in the evening, and we will join the Prairie Home Companion. But just a reminder that this weekend we changed to Yukon Daylight Time, so don't forget to set your clocks ahead 1 hour on tonight when you go to bed.